First, I'd like to thank the organizers very much for giving me this opportunity. It's always very nice to visit PI. So today I'm going to talk about some recent work that I did in collaboration with Zhao Yang, who is my student, and Patrick Hayden. You all know him. It's basically some development along the lines of this way relating tensor networks and holographic duality. So I will first briefly review the previous works. Many of them you heard already on this workshop. And then I'm going to define this new holographic mapping I want to define and discuss its properties. So we don't need any review. Everyone knows what is holography. And all these discussions about quantum tensor networks, the relation of tensor networks and holography are inspired by the seminal work of Ryo Takanagi formula. So we know a relation between entanglement and area, which is very natural thing in tensor networks. So that's why we can think of, there was the proposal of Brent Swingle that we can think of a tensor network, in particular the Mira tensor network, as related to the ADS CFT, related to the hyperbolic space. And basically, if you draw a tensor network and use this to represent a state, which means you only leave the open legs on the boundary to represent a big wave function of these many sites, then this guarantees an upper bound of the entropy by the geodesic area. If you assume the upper bound is saturated, then this may realize the Takanagi formula. So that's the motivation of relating this Mira network to hyperbolic geometry. But as we know, as you have heard from many previous talks, this the detail of this correspondence remains an open question. Like there is a unitary gaze along this radial direction. How do I think that as a anti de Sitter rather than de Sitter space? And there are many things that are still open questions. So then another thing I want to review, which is related to my motivation of this work I'm going to talk about, is this exact holographic mapping that I proposed 2 years ago. So basically, the key difference from the Mira ADS correspondence is I want to use the tensor network to define a mapping between the bulk and boundary rather than defining a state. Or more precisely, we can think of tensor networks in both ways. You can think of tensor networks like the Mira, which represent a state. But you can also use tensor networks to define a unitary mapping between two series. And that's needed to think about the ADS-CFT correspondence, because we not only need a description of states, but we need a description of operators. So we want to know the dictionary. Eventually, we want to have a way to describe the dictionary. So what does an operator in the bulk correspond to on the boundary? So that's why, like, when I describe a network that represents the mapping between the two theories, it can seem a little different from the Mira case. So I can take some sites on the boundary, take some qubits on the boundary, and map it to some low energy degree of freedom and high energy degrees of freedom. And then the low energy degree of freedom are further renormalized to lower energy degrees of freedom, and so on. And then the whole thing is a unitary circuit. And then the output are these red dots, which represent the bulk degrees of freedom. So now I can also include these entanglers in the circuit. That's still unitary. And so whether or not you introduce these entanglers, in general, the output red dots, if you input, say, a ground state of a conformal field theory, then in general, the output is also an entangled state. And the whole mapping only makes sense, only will be meaningful if you choose it correctly such that the output is a short-range entangled state. You don't want it to be like randomly entangled. Then that means you're choosing completely wrong mapping. then there's no sense of defining a geometry. So if you choose a correct mapping, which is like an RG scheme, then you, for your input state, you get an output state, which is short-range entangled. And in that sense, you have mapped your highly entangled state, I mean, highly entangled compared to, say, a massive ground state. Right? So you can have a CFT ground state with a log entropy or something that's even more entangled. You map these states into a less entangled states in a different geometry. That's the whole point of this mapping. So the sketch of the whole logic is you map one state by this circuit to another state. And maybe since the other state should be short-range entangled, you can think there is another tensor network which describes that state, which is something like a mirror. It's not like a mirror. It's like a tensor network that describes a state in the bulk. And then you map that back. You get a state on the boundary. So then we should have a way to measure the geometry. I won't talk much about that because today I'm going to describe a new proposal that's also a holographic mapping, but a different one. But I just want to briefly mention that you can calculate mutual information between different bulk degrees of freedom, because now I have the bulk degrees of freedom, and then you can use that as a way to probe the geometry instead of just saying the geometry is fixed by the tensor network. Okay, so now I have sketched these two different ways to use tensor network. One is to use it as a description of a state. The other is I can use a tensor network to define the mapping between two theories. And then we know there are problems with these approaches, the problems that's shared by both of them. One is that there is a particular direction of the RG. So I'm doing an RG, so there is a direction, which is the gray arrow, that where the gates are unitary. So if you change the center point to another point, this network will not be unitary. So that means there is a particular point, which is the center, and there is a particular direction. So that's not a very nice thing when you compare it with ADS, because ADS is a symmetric space. Every point is supposed to be equivalent. And that's also related to another problem, a deeper problem that's due to the same reason, that if you consider an operator in the bulk, living on some site, like something here, then the whole thing is a unitary circuit, so I can just map it back to the boundary. So as you heard from the talks this morning, you can think this, there is a light cone, like there is a causal cone structure. So an operator here will be some operator that lives on these four sites, eight sites actually. And the operator here will live on four sites. So an operator here will live on that region, and the operator here lives on that region. So basically the radial direction looks like a time-like direction of the Sitter space. So every point corresponds to a unique region on the boundary. And that also clearly violates this symmetry between different boundary regions. Like you can do a conformal transformation on the boundary, which transforms the region A to region B. And these two regions, if you have an operator that is realized in region A, it should also be realized in region B. So this is what was pointed out in this work of M. Harry Dong and C. Dong and Daniel Harrow. So they show that this means some quantum information sense, some error correction property, which means you must map this operator to something that you cannot extract from any small region like this A cross B, the small region, but you can extract it from bigger regions. So the only way to preserve this symmetry is you define a mapping from the bulk operators to the boundary, which is in the low energy space, not one to one, it's a one to multi mapping. And I guess many of this you have heard from Fernando's talk on Monday, so I won't repeat all these, but I wasn't here on Monday, so I'm not sure which part he has talked about. So basically, there is a partial solution to these problems. And there is another problem that's important I want to mention, is so far all these tensor networks are drawn in a large scale, which means it's some kind of tiling of the hyperbolic space. And we are always drawing like one set or of order one set per ADS area. So when you go to more refined the scale, when you go to a shorter scale, you want to put in more points in ADS, you meet a new problem, because the counting start to get problematic. Like for scales bigger than ADS, there is no problem like volume is bigger than area. So volume is the same as the area basically on that scale. The number of points in a given region is the same as the boundary area. So you don't really have any counting problem of defining a correspondence between a 2D theory and a 1D theory. But when you go to more refined scale, this will be a problem you need to explain. So some of these problems are solved in these proposals this happy paper. I don't know, does PYHP becomes the official abbreviation or HPPY? But we know these perfect tensors can solve some of the problems. So let me briefly review them, because what I'm going to do today is I'm going to incorporate the idea of holographic mapping with the idea of the error correction codes and perfect tensor to build some new mapping that has hopefully better properties. So these perfect tensors satisfies the property that so they have even number of legs, for example, 6. And when you have these 6 legs, and the perfectness condition means that there is a unitary mapping between any 3 legs to the other 3 legs. So you can pick any 3 of the 6, and that defines a unitary map from that 3 legs to the other 3. And an equivalent statement is if you trace over 3 legs, look at the entropy of the other 3, it's maximally mixed. So when tensors satisfy this property, it allows you to define unitarity in a way that doesn't specify a direction. This is really the very nice point that usually when you define a unitary circuit, that's like a time evolution. So there is a direction. But if you can draw arrows this way or that way, draw different ways, they are all unitary, then you can define a network that doesn't have any particular direction, but it still have unitarity. It has even more unitarity than Mira, because I can draw the equal sort of equal time slices in different ways. So what the PYHP work defined was there are two kinds of networks, both constructed using these tensors. And one network is like a mirror, is a state. So you just tile these tensors in the hyperbolic space, and that defines the state. And the state has nice properties that the single intervals all satisfy the Ryutaka-Nagi formula. And then there is the other way of using the tensor, which is you use some of the legs to be bulk indices. So that looks like a holographic mapping, which means it has open indices in the bulk. So that's what they call the holographic code. So the holographic code defines a mapping of certain bulk operators, not all the operators, but a subspace, an operator in a subspace. They are mapped to the boundary, and this mapping will satisfy the desired correction properties, which means I can map these operators to this wedge or another wedge. And because this is an isometry from a smaller space of these red points to the boundary, this is an isometry from a smaller space to a bigger space. So this mapping is not one-to-one, and that's why you can have multiple boundary operators which all correspond to one operator in the bulk. So this is nicely reproduced what we expect to have for low energy local operators in a bulk semi-classical geometry. And there are some open questions or some problems that needs further improvement. One is that the state that satisfies Ryutaka-Nagi formula is a different network from the network which gives you the code. So of course, you want a proposal for the mapping between boundary and bulk, which reproduce both. Right? It tells you that the states that correspond to classical geometry satisfy the Ryutake-Nagi formula, and the operators are mapped with this error correction properties. So you want both to be satisfied by one network rather than proposing two networks. So that's one thing that I want to provide some solution. And then the other is this still is a tiling of at the ADS scale. There is no sub ADS physics. So these are the two directions that I want to go a little further. So far, this is the review. Is there any question? Okay, great. So now let me just define what I want to propose. So we want a unitary mapping between boundary and bulk theory. And then we want the bulk to be isotropic, and it has these error correction properties. And we want the geometry to be defined for scales smaller than EDS readers. So, okay. So the definition of my tensor, so the definition of this tensor is a five-leg tensor. So it has one out-of-plane index, which corresponds to a bulk degrees of freedom, and then the other four is in-plane, which I'm going to connect them and form a tensor network. So it has these three properties. So number one property is I want to just to have a unitary mapping, I want to define this bulk index A to have the dimension d to the 4, where d is the dimension of each in-plane leg. And this whole map, this whole tensor is a unitary map from the 4 black lines to the 1 red line. That's very simple to realize, as this property is trivial. Then the other two are more non-trivial requirements to the tensors. So the second property is, if you fix, there is a subset of this d to the 4 dimensional space. So there is d to the 4 dimensional Hilbert space for this site A, and there is a d squared dimensional subspace. And there is a particular basis which is labeled by A equals to 1 to d squared. And for each of these bases, which I denoted here, now you fix this number A equals to 1 of the d squared numbers. Then this is a tensor with 4 legs. And I want to require this tensor to be a perfect tensor, which means it's a unitary from any two inputs to any two outputs. And you change the n to another number, it still satisfies this property.
So it's not a subspace, right?
I mean, it's not a subspace, yes. It's only for this space. Yeah, it's only, if you take zero position of them, it's not true. Right, so it's the space which has classical geometry, which correspond to classical geometry, do not form a linear space, yeah. Which I think is true. Yeah. So yeah.
Is there a certain change in normalization of these tensors going on? Because if it's already a unitary from all the indices to the red guy.
Yeah, you're right. Yes.
And then you insert this space. Right. I mean, in resolution of the identity in that basis, there is some. Quite
yeah, I guess there is a normalization in front. Okay. Yeah. So. Right. If I normalize you are right. So say if I fix this n, then the in-plane is a unitary. Then this if I contract all four legs, I will get some constant, maybe d squared times the identity. Yeah. Okay. So the second property is simply telling me how to reduce to the perfect tensor story. Like if I fix my bulk index, it goes back to a perfect tensor in plane, which is 4 leg in this case. I can also draw 6 legs, and then we can just have all these nice properties that were already in the PYHP paper. Okay, so now the another key property is the number 3, which is now if we use this red arrow as an input. But I'm restricting this input to the subspace. I don't mean subspace which satisfies this property. But when I define a map like this, it is a map from this d squared dimensional subspace together with one of the input lines. to the other three. So this picture is a 4-to-1 mapping to the big space D to the 4-dimensional. And then there is another mapping structure, which is from the D square dimensional smaller space together with one of the leg to the 3-leg. And you see that dimension matches. This is D square times D, which is the same as the other three. So I require this is also unitary. This is also unitary for any choice of the in-plane line. So I can choose this red one with any of the four, and that together defines a unitary map to the other three.
So have you constructed a key that does the job?
Yes, I'm going to show that in two slides. Okay, so before showing explicitly what is that T, I'm going to explain why intuitively these requirements are natural. They are not artificial requirements. So we know why perfect tensors are something natural to do, because according to Page's theorem, the perfect tensor is like a Lagrangian limit. Say it in other words, if I take a random wave function of the four sides and take the dimension D to be large, then almost every random state satisfies this perfect condition, which means the entropy of two sides is almost maximal. I mean, there's corrections, but so basically perfect tensors are like idealized versions of random states on these four sides.
How large are you picking D?
If you randomly take a state, there is some corrections to the perfectness, which means that the entropy is like maximum value subtract something. But the point is, if you find a perfect a particular tensor to exactly satisfy these conditions, then D can be as small as 3.
Right.
So the explicit example I'm going to use is 3. Yeah. But this is saying that why these requirements are natural, because you can imagine you draw a tensor network and take a very large D and then just randomly take a tensor, then by chance, all these properties are already almost satisfied. So the Page theorem says this condition 2 is almost satisfied. But now I'm requiring more conditions. And so instead of thinking of one random state of the four sides, I'm basically talking about D square random states that are orthogonal to each other. But that's also not, also I'm requiring the property 3, which means the property 3 actually can be written in another way, which is that these states are orthogonal when you only do a single set operation. Maybe this is not so transparent, but if I draw it here, so say this is my bulk index and these are the in-plane indices. Now, the property 3 requires that there's a unitary map from these two legs to the other three. Consequently, if I contract this with itself, then this is already an identity. So this is identity. Like this. So consequently, now if I take another single set operator which act on that side, this is a single set operator acting on this side, the other three sides are not acted, then this is just a trace of that operator times identity. So that's this requirement. That's saying that another way to say the property 3 is this: when you view these tensors as different states labeled by n, they are not only orthogonal, but even if you put a single set operator in the between the two states, they are still orthogonal. And these are actually exactly the requirements of thermalization. These are the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which says if you take eigenstate of a random Hamiltonian, eigenstate of an ergodic Hamiltonian, then they satisfy these two conditions, which exactly correspond to the property 2 and 3 I required. And in general, they satisfy in general, the entropy of two sides is not maximal, but a thermal, and this case is like the T equal to infinity limit of that. I mean, it's a little technical here, but the bottom line of the statement is: if you take a random Hamiltonian, diagonalize it, and then you have D to the four eigenstates, and you take D square of them. By chance, you satisfy these conditions.
Why should I think this comes from a Hamiltonian in the first place?
Sorry?
Why should I think this comes from a Hamiltonian
You don't need.
It's a
random state. You don't need.
You don't suppress the probability.
Yeah, the relation to summarization use the Hamiltonian, but actually these are just property of random states. Yeah.
If I take d squared random states with different norms.
No, you take d squared random states. You take d squared random states which are all orthogonal to each other.
And normal.
And normal, yeah. Which basically means you take a orthogonal d squared states and randomly rotate them, and then these properties are satisfied. Yeah.
Is it crucial that this say exactly satisfy these criteria, or is it enough? Will it be enough if it just approximately satisfies everything?
I mean, I think when we want to compare it with ADS CFT, we don't want it to be exactly true, because if it's exactly true, that means the Ryutaki-Nagi formula is exactly true without any correction. And we actually should have like 1 hour in correction. But so far, like what I'm going to talk about is all like when these tensors, I'm choosing the tensors so that they are equally satisfied. It's a very important question, how do I add in these corrections and still know how to do calculation? So the explicit realization, since I'm a little slow here, I won't go to too much details, but basically the construction is I take this for Q-treat code, which is the perfect tensor that's already in the PYHP paper, that's already known before. And that's like a four leg tensor without the fifth leg. And then I apply, the fifth leg is defined by applying some operators on this four leg. So the state nm, because there are d squared states, I'm labeling them by n equals n and m equals to 0, 1, 2. And nm is just some operator acting on 0, 0. And I'm basically just numerically searching all different operators and require that satisfies this condition. And because what I just said, the random state satisfies this condition, it's very easy to just randomly generate some AB and check and find out one that works. So you find out one, this is one nice choice that makes it work. Okay. Yes. Sorry, they are not a Z2 poly. They are Z3 generalization of poly operator. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. It means x z equals to zx. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, I see. So. Okay, so now with the tensor defined, we can just connect the tensors together to make a tensor network. We can connect them into different networks, which can be flat space or curved space. Let me talk about, then we can study the different properties of this network. So the first property is if we keep this big Hilbert space on every side, which is d to the 4 dimensional, then for any network, this defines the unitary map, defines the isometry from boundary to bulk. And this is simply means that because you already have a unitary between from the four legs of every site to the red line. So when I connect these to a tensor network, I'm just connecting some of the black lines. So it's like you just project some of the lines into EPR pairs. And then you use the remaining part as your open boundary indices. So it's still unitary. It's still isometry. So because if you contract the bulk lines, you get identity. So this is just like almost a trivial property, but this allows me to define the mapping. So I just glue these networks in whatever way I like, and that always define a mapping from the boundary theory to some bulk theory. And that bulk theory has a naive Hilbert space, which can be very, very big, which are these d to the 4 on every side. But I don't consider that as my physical Hilbert space. I consider boundary theory as my physical theory, and the bulk theory as like a redundant representation of that theory in a bigger Hilbert space. OK, so then what are the properties of that network? Before that, I just want to show that how it looks like when you refine hyperbolic tiling. So you can replace every vertex by a lot of them in a flat like grid. So then this is like the picture you have in mind when you think about a hyperbolic space, and we have a sub ADS scale point. ADS scale is like that. Okay, so what properties do we have for this mapping? So it has some gauge invariance because it's redundant, because we connect the some lines. So the bulk is a redundant representation of the boundary. And that redundancy can be formulated into a gauge symmetry, which is simply saying that I can define unitaries that act on the auxiliary lines. And as long as they cancel each other pairwisely, then they don't do anything to your boundary. Let's say these are the boundary lines. These are the lines you contracted. Then you can do this GG inverse and doesn't do anything to the boundary, right? But on the other hand, each of these vertex is unitary. So I can find a W acting on the bulk index, which does the same thing as the G1, G2 here. So once you define, so this W is defined such that when you apply something to this red line, it's equivalent to G1, G2. And you apply W2 to that line, it's equivalent to G1 inverse, G2 inverse. So of course, by definition, this equals to that. And this is the gauge symmetry of the bulk theory. And this is a simple example where you only connected two lines. More generally, if you have a vertex in the bulk, say somewhere here, then all the four lines are contracted. So you can define this W to be doing the transformations that are G, 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 G on every leg. So notice, maybe it's not so transparent, but this is very different from ordinary gauge symmetry. But usually what happens for gauge symmetry is you have a gauge transformation on every side, and the gauge invariant quantity is like a vector connecting two sides that's transformed by the two symmetries, by the two gauge transformations. Here, the gauge transformations are defined on each link. And something that plays the role of the gauge vector potential, which is transformed by gauge symmetry, gauge transformations, is defined on this vertex. And it's transformed by all these links connecting to this line. And as a consequence, you see there is a very different consequence from gauge theory, which is there is no local operator. You can take a network like this, and then look at the interior. So by interior, I mean the sides in the bulk that are not directly connected to the boundary. Say this red one, this side is next to the boundary, and then everything in this dashed box is in the interior. And then basically the statement is any operator that acts on the bulk Hilbert space only in this box is trivial. The expectation value of that is trivial. Because when you contract the first layer on the boundary, you already like break the connection between the inside and outside. Well, another way to say that is this W is a gauge transformation, and you see the gauge group is SUD times SUD times SUD times SUD. And this gauge transformation is ergodic, which means that there is no operator other than identity, which is preserved by the gauge symmetry. So there is no local operator which is gauge invariant. They are not independent. They have to agree here.
What does that imply, that agreement restriction approach? How do I know what set of W's is an allowed gauge transformation?
So basically, you just say you take a network like this, and then give a G for every line, and that defines the W. Because let's say I draw a oriented line. And then I put a G here, G, G, G. Then that defines W here and defines W here. So that's why I say the gauge transformations are actually defined on the links.
Yeah.
And you sort of think of the W as some kind of dual Plaquet property, Plaquet quantity, which is transformed. It's like a higher form gauge field, which is transformed by all the edges connecting to it. That's why when I try to build some gauge invariant quantities, I cannot, like in the gauge theory, like I'm just drawing some loop, then I get gauge invariant quantity. Here, if I want to get something that's invariant under gauge transformation, it has to cover the whole space. Because I want something that has no edge. Because the gauge transformation are defined on the edges.
Is it enough to have a line that joins some point on the edge to the interior? Crosses the interior?
No, it's something like this. Okay, so I was just saying that if you have an operator acting on this region, which does not bound the boundary, then it's trivial. Then this is proportional to identity. If I have an operator that lives in a region that bounds the boundary, then the gauge invariant projection of that operator is not trivial. But if you want to explicitly write down a gauge invariant operator, it's probably covering the whole space. I mean, this operator is not gauge invariant. It just has a gauge invariant component with it. So if you look at the gauge invariant operator, it has to cover the whole space because the boundary, because otherwise this line is going to be transformed by a gauge transformation. So I think, I mean, this gauge symmetry in the bulk, it has some analogy with general covariance, with diffeomorphism, because it tells me that it's like a gravity theory in the sense that there is no local operators. And if you want some operator in the bulk, which does have some non-trivial effect to the boundary, you have to define it in a region that bounds the boundary. It basically means like what you really think as local operators are actually operators that act here while also specifying what is the background geometry, at least in a wedge. That's kind of. It means that when we, okay, maybe that becomes more transparent when we go to the low energy operators. It means, I mean, what we usually think as a local operator in the low energy theory it should actually be thought as I'm doing a local operation on this site, but that's while I already know the whole background. So that's why I should think it as a local operator. Because it's like gauge fix the background to something and then do something locally. So that's why it's actually not local. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about some other properties, which are the properties of this smaller Hilbert space. So on every site, there are these D square dimensional smaller Hilbert space, which satisfy these nice properties. So the consequence of that, of course, first consequence is already clear that if I build a network that's either flat or negatively curved, then because of this perfect tensor, the perfect property on every site, then the Ryutaka-Nagi formula is satisfied for any single interval on the boundary. So this is this part is already proved in the PYOHP work, because once I fix the bulk index, then the boundary, then the remaining indices in plane just build a state. Right? So in other words, when I think of this as a mapping, when I think of the network as a mapping, and it maps the product state in the bulk in this smaller Hilbert space. It maps any product state to a state that satisfies the Ryutaka-Nagi formula. So in other words, it tells me these direct product states without the entanglement in the bulk are mapped to particular states on the boundary with these properties of entanglement. So you can see more explicitly how it works. Let's take a toy model, which is, let's take a pentagon case like this, and then we draw arrows, and these arrows are supposed to show there is a unitary map there is a isometry from the geodesic to the boundary, and the way you show that is you show there is a unitary map from the geodesic and the red part to the blue part. I'm going to use this picture again, so I want to explain it. Although this is basically just following the previous work, so you can draw these arrows and then make sure there is no loop, make sure it's conserved, so that defines the unitary mapping. And as a consequence, the entropy of this thing is the same as the entropy of this gamma A. And you also need to show that there is the same kind of isometry from this line to the complement. And then that means the system, the entanglement between A and this complement is just EPR pairs with that number, with the length of the geodesic. Okay, so as Matt asked before, if I take superpositions of these states, in general, you don't satisfy your Ryutaka-Nagi formula. Right? So it's a special property of these states. Okay, so then now we can make use of the other property I defined, the property 3.
But the thing which defines the condition which defines these states is ultra local. I mean, just each point in the ball.
Yes.
One. it's a little strange, isn't it? Normally, I would think there's.
You mean like why? Because the box theory is non-local.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true in quantum gravity. I mean, it seems
I mean,
maybe it is.
I would like to think of the boundary Hilbert space as the physical Hilbert space.
Yeah.
And when we map to a box, there is a redundancy, there is this gauge theory, gauge constraints. And this gauge constraint does mean if you look at the, if you write them in terms of constraints to the box Hilbert space, there are more and more local constraints when you go to bigger regions. The tensors, the tensors satisfy local rules, but when you it's when you map the boundary Hilbert space to the bulk, you see all these non-local conditions. Actually, we'll see some of them later. So now let's start from the simplest case where we want to go from a state to a code. So this defines a state. If you fix the state on every site in the fix the bulk index to say zero for every site, say zero zero. Then now I want to say, okay, what if I fix everything else to be zero, but then I apply some operators on one of the sites? And then we want to ask whether there is an isometry which maps this operator to the boundary. And the answer is yes, because I can just redraw the arrows so that you see, say at everywhere else, I'm fixing the box site. So it's a 2-to-2, it's a 2-to-2 unitary. And then here, when I flip the arrows on this red line, I defined 2-to-3 unitary. That's the thing I defined according to the other property, to the property 3 I have, which is the bulk line together with one input gives me a unitary to the other 3 output. And then, so that tells me there is a unitary mapping from these input lines and this bulk input line. And that proves that if I have a bulk operator here, it's mapped to the boundary with isometry. Okay, so this is how you see this network starts to work, which gives you both a state and a mapping. It gives you a state, gives you these particular states, which are product states in the bulk. They are states with RT formula on the boundary. And when you apply operators acting on these states, at least we have shown now that for a single site operator, it defines the isometry to the boundary.
Wait, so did you get the same entropy regardless of which bulk state you picked?
That's right.
As long as it was classical.
Right, as long as you are in the D-square, one of the D-square states on every side.
So these are not different classical field configurations, or they are classical? Why should I think of them?
I would like to think of one of them. Like there is one particular one which is chosen by energetic conditions, by say the Hamiltonian. So everywhere is zero, that's my ground state. And then all the low energy excitations are like there is a dilute gas of some excitations which flip it to other states. So that's obtained by applying some like several points, some operators in the bulk, but not too many of them.
But in the analogy to holography, and maybe this is just pushing the analogy too far, I don't know, but morally, should I think of it as like a new gravitational background, like a new metric, or a new state of the fields about a fixed background? Like I've excited a gas of some photons or something, but
yeah.
Not enough to back react?
I would like to think like if I excite a field point in the bulk, that's like a graviton or a photon. It's like having a field in the bulk. But this network, I mean, it has the property that if I flip all the sites from say n equal to zero to n equal to one, then the whole thing has the same has the same entanglement entropy, and that's I don't think that's natural in the holography case. So I don't know what
the property of that is. That a special property of that state, or are you saying?
I mean, it's a consequence of this construction, but I don't know what the corresponding. I mean, it seems like too much to require, because in general, what we need is this zero state, which satisfies this unitary condition in plane, and then we want to do some small change to it, and then use this condition that it's still unitary going out. But I don't know how to interpret it, like the fact that if I go to a highly excited state in the bulk by flipping a lot of the sites, but the bulk is still in the product state, then you still satisfy the same entanglement property. That I don't know if that's just an accidental consequence of this construction or it has some more deep meaning. But so far, so to clarify, the property of this network is any product state in the bulk, as long as every site has one of the D square states, it satisfies Yutaka Nagi formula. But then you should think one of these as the ground state, and then, or as to the leading order classical limit as the ground state. Then excitations are like some few excitations that are moving around, which will change the entanglement property. So I would like to mention some thing that's related to, possibly related to these words like entanglement wedge and causal wedge. I mean, I'm not sure if I'm using this in the right sense, but basically what it means is that for any given boundary region, it's proved that there is a geodesic. Well, actually, in general, if it's flat space, there is multiple geodesics. If I draw a square lattice, but anyway, there is a geodesic which gives you the entropy. But it's not true that any operator like in all these sites in this region has an isometry to this part of the boundary. It has an isometry to the boundary, but it may go out. So there is a smaller wedge, which is the red line, the operators that in this region between the red line and the boundary, has an isometry to the boundary. But there is some part in between like this one. If I want to map that to the boundary, I have to enlarge the region because I have to go here. So there is some interesting difference between the two. But the difference is never very big. It's never bigger than the ADS readers. Okay, so now let's think about instead of the single site operator, let's think about multi-site operators in the bulk and ask what happens. So we basically start to flip more arrows and so on. So you can try to define isometries and see if it works. And some cases it works, some cases it doesn't. Like this case, it doesn't work. If I have four sites here, there is no isometry from these four sites to the boundary. So finally it will fail because the number of bulk points is much higher than the number of boundary points. So of course these bulk points cannot be independent from each other, which means there are some operators that act on many sites which are mapped to zero. The question is how easy is it to discover that? If it's very easy, if it's all like local rules, then you claim, say for example, if you make a wrong network without these properties, then what can happen, like if you make a general PAP, what can happen is all the operators that are around the boundary are mapped to something non-trivial, and anything in the interior are mapped to something trivial. So that's one way to keep this work, right? That's one way to keep the counting correct. But here, the key thing is once you have these properties, the rule for allowed configuration becomes very complicated, becomes very non-local. So actually any 1, 2, 3 point operators are completely independent, which means they are mapped to boundary by isometries. And when you go beyond the three, you have more and more configurations that are not allowed. But we can do a counting. We can ask, okay, how many configurations are allowed? So let's take a L by L square. So now we're doing holography in flat space. We have L by L square. And then we take n random points in the bulk and ask, is this configuration mapped to the boundary with an isometry? And we look at all these L square n configurations. We look at all these number of configurations and how many of them are mapped to the boundary with an isometry. And there is an interesting behavior of this ratio. So basically by drawing arrows, which are equivalent to like giving it a height function and draw these gradient vectors, this is supposed to be like the contour of the height function. And you start from here and then there's a gradient of the height function which gives you the arrow drawing. So by drawing the arrows, we can get a lower limit of that number. Because if you find a way to draw the arrows, there must be an isometry, but the reverse is not true. There are cases where you can't prove to be unitary this way, but actually it is unitary. It is isometry. So this is a lower limit, which tells me that if your number of points is smaller than some constant times square root L, this ratio goes to 1. And what that means is if you look at a very large L, then you try to discover that you actually have a theory that's living on the boundary. You actually have an area law, Hilbert space rather than volume law. What you have to do is you have to take an endpoint function where n is bigger than square root L. So that's the meaning of this, the fact that the box theory is actually a theory with area law Hilbert space, but it looks like a theory with volume law Hilbert space. It looks like a quantum field theory in two plus one dimensions until you look at very complicated correlation functions. And actually, this is a lower bound, and actually it can get much better. So when we take this Q-treat stabilizer code, you can explicitly calculate these entropies. So this was calculated by two students, Cizhi Han and Zhao Yang, and we learned a lot from Benny Yoshida for how to calculate these entropies. So basically, you can pick some points in the bulk and then calculate the entropies efficiently so that you can figure out what points are mapped to the boundary. And for this, the Q-treat code is very good because in the large system size limit, the critical n is 2L minus 1, which is almost like as good as it can be. It means that the bulk, as long as, so if you have 4L size on the boundary, you have to check like 2L minus 1, or you have to check 2L points in the bulk to figure out that actually they are not independent. Of course, it can't work for anything bigger than 2L. So it's almost like as good as it can go to. So this is the kind of the kinematic way to tell me this theory, in some sense, is a gravitational theory, which means that the Hilbert space is actually has the dimension of the boundary, but it's very hard to discover that. Which means at low energy, when you have very dilute excitations, they all look independent with probability 1. So now this is the main like calculational results I would like to present, and I would like to just have some more discussions in the remaining few minutes about what's the implication. So basically, the holographic code defined by the PYHP work defines a mapping from a subspace, which is smaller dimensional, to the boundary physical qubits, The point of this new proposal is when you go to sub-ADS scales, there are many more points in the bulk. And then the point is that you define a family, you define families of holographic codes, which means you can pick a random choice of bulk points. Each choice is contains a smaller point, a smaller number of sites as the boundary, or maybe similar number of sites. But the point is many choices can work. So consequently, this redundancy in the bulk is not a problem anymore, that every bulk point looks equivalent. And you can think of a continuum limit in this way without worrying about the counting problem. So say you can have like the choice of the red dots or the blue one or the purple or the yellow. It's also this fact that I have to make a choice of some points in the bulk and to build a holographic code is also consistent with the intuition that the low energy subspace, the low energy operator should not form a closed algebra, which means you apply a low energy operator many times, you should get a high energy operator, right? So we shouldn't have low energy operator form a closed algebra. So if you think of this fixed position of the bulk points, like in the holographic code, they form an algebra. So the fact they don't form an algebra is exactly the fact that you can choose different allowed configurations, but when you put all of them together, it's not allowed. So since I'm running out of time, I just want to quickly comment that it seems based on this construction, it seems like many different schemes we heard on this meeting are starting to converge. So now. If we fix the bulk state to be a product state, then this actually defines not only a state on the boundary, but it defines a state for every region, because I can draw an arbitrary region and then define the state by contracting tensors in that region. So this I think directly is an explicit realization of this surface state correspondence of Tadashi and collaborators. So also this tensor defines isometries between different regions. I can deform the blue line to the I can deform the red to blue by isometries, but I cannot deform this red by to that orange line, because there is no isometry, because you have to deform three edges to one edge. So it tells you what are these allowed moves that define the isometries. So in that sense, it's sort of like a generalization of this kinematic space story. Like I can generalize it to an infinite dimensional loop space, like for any, not loop, for any domain, because the loop has to be contractible. For any domain, I define a state, and there is a partial order between these states defined by isometries. And a more concrete consequence of this way of thinking of the story is we can think of entropy of a bulk region. So when we talk about entropy in a bulk region, we can't think of that as an entanglement entropy of this region with the rest of the system, because at least in this way, in this construction, we can't think of it that way, because you contract the tensors in the interior of this disk, it's a pure state. You contract the interior, it's a pure state. But you can define the entanglement entropy of any part of the boundary, which is like any edge of a polygon, with the remaining part. And that is maximal for a disk. And then you can sum over this entropy. This is literally following Tadashi's proposal as this in his surface state correspondence. But in the tensor network, it's explicitly realized that you can calculate the entropy of every edge and sum over them. And then you get entropy that's proportional to the area. And that's actually maximal because every edge is maximally entangled with the rest. So then when you, now this corresponds to the case where every bulk set is like zero, is a fixed state. Now, if you don't fix them, but you make them into certain entangled states, then this entropy should change. I mean, it would be very interesting if we can relate this to the story, to the theory we heard from Ted yesterday, how to relate to Einstein equations, which I don't know, but I'm hoping that the bulk entropy, at least, is explicitly defined in this tensor network. Okay, so that's all I want to say. And I think the open questions are like, how do I write down a Hamiltonian? And how do I incorporate a Lorentz symmetry, take continuum limit? And how do I think about the Schlitter space? Many open questions. Thanks.
So it doesn't seem on the surface like it would be that hard to go to higher dimensions just right. by adding more legs. Is that true? Would it carry through?
Yeah, I think it will, but I haven't really checked any example. I mean, you can certainly make a network of the perfect tensors with higher dimensions. I guess the Ryotaro and Nagi formula in a non-positive curvature space should still be true. I don't know how does the counting work. I'm not sure.
What about the restriction on the curve? I mean, what would go wrong if I made something with positive curvature out of your?
So it's like if your space has some bump like this. Then I cannot prove this entropy is equal to the geodesic if the geodesic is like that, because I cannot deform this to that. But if I deform this curve gradually to here and goes down, then it lost the unitarity because the length is increasing and then decreasing.
But can I make a network that looks
you
like
can.
That to begin with?
You can.
And then is there something obviously wrong with the?
No, nothing wrong. It's just saying RT formula do not work, but it's still a well-defined state of the boundary. It's a well-defined state. Like I can even make a case of a sphere, like the Schlitter case. I can just make a state of the sphere, and that defines a well-defined state in the bulk. And it's interesting to study what is the property of that state. I don't know.
Yeah. So you know, if you talk about the reduced density matrix, does that have a scratch spectrum or
in the bulk or boundary?
In the boundary reduced
density matrix. For the single interval, certainly it has a flat spectrum. That's why it doesn't contain all these any of the correction. Like it doesn't have this information.
Can you modify the network so that it does that?
If we just generically modify the network, say for example, the simplest thing we can do is for every site, I don't take it to be 0 or 1 or any of them. I take a superposition between 0 and 1. Then this in-plane tensor is not perfect anymore. So you will get a nice flat entanglement spectrum and power law correlations between different points. But I just don't know how, in general, how I calculate this thing.
So how about the bulk entanglement? You have a bulk state and if you compute the entanglement?
Yeah.
Do you expect that to also coincide with area flows or you include also quantum corrections?
But it depends on what state you take. I can map a boundary state to the bulk.
Yeah, and so, you have a bulk state.
So the bulk state, the bulk state depends on the boundary state. So I'm expecting the bulk lines to be short range entangled. So in the classical limit, I'm assuming my boundary ground state is the product state in the bulk. So I can consider going away from that limit. Say I can write down something like an Ising model in the bulk, which is deeply in the disorder phase, but not completely. So I can have like every site is not completely polarized, but there is some entanglement. But I think I will always want to think of the limit where I have a short range entanglement in the box. Otherwise, I should resolve the
state where the bulk entanglement is somehow very maximal. Some region in the bulk and some other region is maximal entanglement.
Yeah, you can have that. I can design that state because unless I have another way to determine the input state from the boundary, because if I don't specify the input state on the boundary, then I can just design any state in the bulk, right? So I can choose a particular state. Yeah. So I will expect that the thermal double state is represented by some wormhole geometry, but that's kind of like it's not a non-trivial statement because I can just design that state that way. Yeah.
Do you understand that at scale this model recovers an isotropic property? Because it certainly looks, at least from it certainly looks as if I just want to know if that if you recover isotropy above or below the ADS.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I don't know any way to make it isotropic. So if I think of continuum limit, this is a problem because this thing, if I take like many lines here, it's like a polygon. I mean it's like a flat patches glued together. So I don't know how to make the curvature smooth. Well, in principle, you can do that by maybe drawing a more and more complicated tiling. So you have like a small sources of curvature rather than pentagons. Like pentagon is the source of curvature. So this disk is like with delta function curvatures at each pentagon. In principle, maybe if you allow me to draw a non-planar diagram, then I can go to go to curvature centers with a very small curvature. But I don't know what's a nice way to do that. Maybe a random tiling of ADS.
Okay, let's
thank you.